distance. To our left and right, at right angles, he murmured back to Aldrich. Aren't you going to talk? Aldrich asked, his voice a lazy drawl. Fidelius reached up a hand to scratch at his neck, squinting at the Marat. These three evidently disagree with their Chauvin, their chief. They aren't interested in talking.
Odiana let out a breathy, Oh, goody.
The former cursor gripped the hilt of the knife that hung at the back of his neck and whipped his arm forward and down. There was a flicker of grey light on steel, and then the spike-like throwing knife buried itself in the herdbane, its handle protruding from the bird's head, just where its beak met its skull. The herdbane let out a scream and leapt into the air in a great spasm. It fell to the forest floor, screaming still, thrashing viciously in its agony. From the left and right came a sudden shriek of sound, the war cries of the birds and their masters, one savage paired with a bird rushing the group from either side. Fidelius felt more than saw Aldrich slip to the ground and turn to face one pair, but he heard quite clearly the rasp of the man's sword being drawn. Odiana murmured something under her breath, a soft cooing sound. The lead Marat rushed to the fallen herdbane's side for a moment, and then with a decisive motion ripped the hook-shaped knife over the bird's throat. The herdbane let out a final weak whistle and then shuddered to stillness on the ground as its blood stained the earth. Then the Marat turned toward Fidelius with his face set in a flat, murderous rage and flung himself at the former cursor. Fidelius barked a command to Vama and flicked his hand in his attacker's direction. The ground beneath the Marat bucked in response, throwing him to one side, sending him sprawling. Fidelius took the opportunity to dismount from his increasingly agitated horse and to draw the dagger from the sheath at his hip. The Marat regained its balance and rushed him, aiming to move past his opponent, raking the horrible knife along Fidelius's belly in passing, disemboweling him. Fidelius was familiar with the technique and countered by facing the Marat squarely, meeting his rush with one boot abruptly thrust out at the Marat's knee. He felt his foot connect hard, and something snapped in the Marat's leg. The Marat let out a squall and fell, whipping its knife at Fidelius's thigh as it did. The Alaran pushed away from the Marat's body in the same motion, pulling his leg clear a finger's width ahead of the knife, then turned to face his opponent. The Marat attempted to rise to his feet, only to have his knee buckle. He fell into the pine needles. Fidelius turned and walked toward the nearest tree, glancing back at the others as he did. Aldrich stood at the edge of the clearing, facing out, his blade gripped and held parallel to the ground, his arm extended straight out to his side, an almost dance-like pose. Behind the swordsman lay a herdbane, its head missing, its body flopping and clawing wildly, evidently unaware of its own impending death. The Marat that had rushed Aldrich knelt on the forest floor, its head lowered and swaying, its hands pressing at its belly and stained with blood. On the other side of the clearing, Odiana sat on her horse, humming quietly to herself. The ground in front of her had, it had seemed, quite abruptly transformed into bog. Neither Marat nor herdbane could be seen, but the silt and mud before her stirred vaguely, as though something thrashed unseen beneath its surface. The water witch noticed him looking at her and commented, her tone warm,
I love the way the ground smells after a rain.
Fidelius didn't answer her. He reached up instead, using his knife to make a deep cut, scoring a branch on the nearest tree. He broke it off, and as the others turned to watch him, put his knife away, took the heavy branch in both hands, and from out of the lamed Marat's knife reach, methodically clubbed him to death.
That's one way to do it, Aldrich commented. If you don't mind spattering blood everywhere.
Fidelius tossed the branch down to one side.
You got blood everywhere, he pointed out.
Aldrich walked back to the clearing's center. He took a handkerchief from his pocket and used it to fastidiously clean his blade.
But mine's in a pattern. It's aesthetically pleasing. You should have had me do it for you. Dead's dead, Fidelius said. I can do my own chores.
He glanced at Odiana and said,
Happy now?
The water witch, still atop her horse, smiled at him and let out a little sigh.
Do you think we shall have more rain?
Fidelius shook his head and called out,
That's a rock. You saw what they intended.
He had the satisfaction of seeing Aldrich tense and half turn to one side, and even Odiana caught her breath in her throat. The former cursor smiled and took up his horse's reins, laying a hand on the beast's neck and stroking it. From the trees came a gravelly voice, a satisfied-sounding, Ha! Then there was the sound of motion through the brush, and a fourth Marat appeared. This man had eyes of glittering, brilliant gold, a match for those of the sleek, swift-looking bird beside him. He wore his knife at his belt rather than in his hand, and he also carried a sword, bound with a rawhide thong about its hilt and blade, and slung over one shoulder. He had a half-dozen grass plaits bound over his limbs, and his face had been rawly abraded, bruised. The Marat stopped several paces from the trio and held up his hands, open, palms toward them. Fidelius mirrored the gesture and stepped forward.
What I did was necessary.
Atzerak looked down at the dead man only a few paces away, whose skull Fidelius had crushed.
It was necessary, the man agreed, his voice quiet. But a waste. Had they met me openly, I would have killed only one.
The Marat squinted at Odiana, staring at the woman with a silent, hawk-like intensity before turning an equally intent regard to Aldrich.
Deadlanders. They fight well.
Time is pressing, Fidelius responded. Is everything in readiness?
I am the Chauvin of my tribe. They will follow me.
Fidelius nodded and turned to his horse.
Then we go.
Wait, Atzerak said, lifting a hand. There is a problem.
Fidelius paused and looked at the Marat chieftain.
During the last sun, I hunted humans not far from this place. Impossible, Fidelius said. No one goes here.
The Marat took the sword from his shoulder and with a pair of casual motions unbound the thong from the weapon. He flicked it forward so that its point drove into the ground a pace ahead and to one side of Fidelius.
I hunted humans,
Atzerak said as though Fidelius hadn't spoken.
Two males, old and young. The old commanded a spirit of the earth. My Chala, the mate to this one,
he put his hand on the herdbane's feathered back,
was slain. Wounded the old one. I hunted them, but the young one was swift and led me from his trail.
Aldrich stepped forward and took up the sword from the ground. He used the same cloth he had cleaned his own weapon with to brush the mud from the blade.
Legion issue, he reported, his eyes distant. Design from a few years ago. Well cared for. The wrappings are worn smooth.
He took off a glove and touched his skin to the blade, his eyes closing.
Someone with a measure of experience used this, Del. I think he's a Legion scout. Or was one.
Fidelius drew in a sharp breath.
Atzerak. These two you hunted, they are dead?
Atzerak shrugged.
The old one's blood flowed like a stream. His spirit carried him away, but he was already pouring out into the earth. The young one ran well and was fortunate.
Fidelius spat a sudden acid taste out of his mouth and clenched his jaw.
I understand. I have come to look at this valley, and I have seen. I have seen that the Deadlanders wait to fight, that they are strong and watch carefully.
Fidelius shook his head.
You were unfortunate, Atzerak. Nothing more. The attack will be a victory for your people. I question your judgment. The Marat have come. Many tribes have come. But though they have no love for your people, they have little for me. They will follow me to a victory, but not to a slaughter. All is in readiness.
Your people will sweep clean the valley of your fathers and mothers, and my lord will see to it that it is returned to you. So he has pledged.
Atzerak's lip curled into something like a sneer.
You're Chauvin. Chauvin of the Aquitaine. Do you bear his totem as bond?
Fidelius nodded, once.
I will see it.
Fidelius stepped back to his horse and opened one of the saddlebags. From it he drew Aquitaine's dagger, its hilt elaborately worked with gold and with the seal of the House of Aquitaine. He held it up, so that the savage could see the weapon.
Satisfied?
Atzerak extended his hand. Fidelius narrowed his eyes.
This was not a part of our agreement.
The Marat's eyes flashed with something hot, vicious. He said in a very soft voice,
Nor was the death of my Chala. Already there is bad blood between your people and mine. Now there is more. You will give me your Chauvin's totem as bond, and then I will fulfill my end of the bargain.
Fidelius frowned, and then he flicked the knife, still in its scabbard, to the Marat in an underhand throw. Atzerak caught it without looking, nodded, and turned to walk back into the woods. A few paces past the first branches, he and the stalking bird beside him vanished. Aldrich stared after the savage chieftain for a moment and then at Fidelius.
I want to know what in the name of all the furies you think you are doing.
Fidelius glared at the man, then turned back to his mount and secured the saddlebags again.
You heard him. Something's got the Marat spooked. Without the dagger he wasn't staying.
Aldrich's expression darkened.
That's a signet weapon. It can be traced back to Aquitaine. He's a Marat horde master. He's going to be fighting in the front of the bloody battle.
Fidelius grated his teeth and spoke in a slow, patient tone.
Yes, Aldrich. It can. Yes, Aldrich. He will. Thus, we had best be damned sure that the attack succeeds.
Fidelius slapped the saddlebags back over the horse.
After the valley has been taken, it won't matter what plunder the Marat have. Events will be in motion by then, and it will all fall into politics.
Aldrich gripped Fidelius by the shoulder and spun the smaller man to face him. The swordsman's eyes were hard.
If it doesn't, there's evidence. If it gets back to the Senate, they'll bring charges against him, Fidelius. Treason!
The former cursor glanced down at Aldrich's hand, then up the length of the swordsman's arm to his face. He met his eyes in silence for several seconds before saying,
You're a brilliant fighter, Aldrich. You could kill me right here, and we both know it. But I've been playing the game for a long time, and we both know that you can't do it before I have a chance to react. You'll be less of a swordsman without your hand. Without your feet.
He let the words hang in the air for a moment, and the ground shifted very slightly beneath the pair of them as Vama stirred through the earth. Fidelius let his voice drop to something quiet, cool. He used the same tone when ordering a man to dig his own grave.
Make up your mind. Dance or stand down?
Silence stretched between them. The swordsman looked away first, his stance shifting back into his usual relaxed slouch. He picked up the weapon the Marat had left and stood facing the other way for a moment. Fidelius let out a slow, silent breath and waited for the too quick pulse in his throat to slow down again. Then he turned and mounted his horse, folding his hands over the pommel to hide their trembling.
It's a necessary risk. We'll take precautions.
Aldrich nodded. His expression unhappy, resolved.
What precautions?
Fidelius jerked his chin toward the sword.
We start with finding these two who have actually seen the Marat in the valley. If that belonged to a retired scout, he might work out what's going on.
Odiana nudged her horse over to Aldrich's, took the reins, and led the mount over to the man, her eyes on Fidelius, her expression pensive. The swordsman mounted and slipped the captured sword away into a strap behind the saddle.
"So we find them. Then what?"
Fidelius turned his horse and started riding out of the clearing, aiming their path in a gentle circle around the outside of the mountain, toward the causeway, where he was most likely to find the signs of anyone passing from the mountain, and toward the nearest steadhold.
"We find out what they know,"
Odiana asked.
"And if they know too much?"
Fidelius glanced at his riding gloves and flicked a drying spot of blood from one of them.
"We make sure they stay quiet."
Chapter 14.
"And that's what happened," Tarvi said. "It all started with that one little lie, and all I wanted to do was to get those sheep back, show my uncle that I could handle things without anyone's help, that I was independent and responsible."
He picked up a rind from one of the bright orange fruits and threw it back into the plants at the water's edge, scowling, his thoughts in a turmoil.
"You don't have any furies at all?" the slave repeated, her voice still stunned. "None?"
Tarvi hunched his shoulders against her tone and gathered the scarlet cloak closer around him, as though the fabric might ward off the sensation of isolation her words brought him. His voice came out harsher than he'd meant it to, defensive.
"That's right. So? I'm still a good herder. I'm the best apprentice in the valley. Furies or not?"
"Oh," Amara said quickly.
"No, I didn't mean to—"
"No one means to," Tarvi said.
"But they all do. They look at me like I'm crippled, even though I can run. Like I'm blind, even though I can see. It doesn't matter what I do or how well I do it, everyone looks at me the same way."
He shot her a glance and said, "Like you are right now."
Amara frowned and rose, her torn skirts and her appropriated cloak swaying about her ankles.
"I'm sorry," she said. "Tarvi, it's unusual, I know. I've never heard of anyone with that problem before. But you're also young. It's possible that you just haven't grown into it yet. I mean, you're, what, 12, 13?
15, Tarvi mumbled.
He rested his chin on his knees and sighed. Amara winced.
"I see. And you're worried about your service in the legions?"
"What service?" Tarvi said. "I don't have any furies. What are the legions going to do with me? I won't be able to send signals like the aircrafters, hold the lines with the earthcrafters, or attack with the firecrafters. I won't be able to heal anyone with the watercrafters. I can't forge a sword or wield one like a metalcrafter. I can't scout and hide or shoot like a woodcrafter. And I'm small. I'm not even good for handing a spear and fighting in the ranks. What are they going to do with me?"
"No one will be able to question your courage, Tarvi. You showed me that last night."
"Courage," Tarvi sighed. "As near as I can figure it, all courage gets you is more of a beating than if you'd run away."
"Sometimes that's important," she pointed out. "Taking a beating, not running away."
He frowned and said nothing. The slave remained silent for several moments before she settled down beside him, wrapping the scarlet cloak around her. They listened to the rain outside for a few moments. When Amara spoke, her words took Tarvi off guard.
"What would you do if you had a choice?"
"What?"
Tarvi quirked his head and looked up at her.
"If you could choose anything to do with your life, anywhere to go," Amara said, "what would you do? Where would you go?"
"The academy," he said at once. "I'd go there. You don't have to be a crafter there. You just have to be smart, and I am. I can read and write and do figures. My aunt taught me."
She lifted her brows.
"The academy?
It isn't just for knights, you know," Tarvi said. "They train legates there and architects and engineers, counselors, musicians, artists. You don't have to be a skilled crafter to design buildings or argue law."
Amara nodded.
"Or you could be a curser."
Tavi wrinkled up his nose and snorted. And spend my life delivering mail? How exciting could that be? The slave nodded, her expression sober. Good point. Tavi swallowed against a sudden tightness in his throat. Out here, on the Steadholt, crafting keeps you alive. Literally. Back in the cities it isn't as important. You can still be someone other than a freak. You can make your own life for yourself. The Academy is the only place in Alera where you can do that.
Sounds like you've thought about this a lot, Amara said quietly.
My uncle saw it once when his legion was on review for the First Lord. He told me about it, and I've talked to soldiers on their way up to garrison, traders. Last spring, Uncle promised me that if I showed him enough responsibility, he'd give me a few sheep of my own. I figured out that if I took care of them and sold them next year and saved up all of my pay from the legions that I could put together enough money for a semester at the academy.
One semester? Amara asked. What then?
Tavi shrugged. I don't know. Try to find some way to stay. I might be able to get someone to be a patron, or... I don't know. Something.
She turned to look at him for a moment and said, You're very brave, Tavi.
My uncle will never give me the sheep after this, if he's not dead.
The tightness in his throat choked him and he bowed his head. He could feel tears filling his closed eyes.
I'm sure he's all right, the slave said.
Tavi nodded, but he couldn't speak. The anguish he'd been trying to keep stuffed down inside rose up in him and the tears fell onto his cheeks.
Uncle Bernard couldn't be dead. He just couldn't. How would Tavi ever be able to live with that? How would he ever face his aunt?
Tavi lifted his fist and shoved angrily at the tears staining his cheeks.
At least you're alive, Amara pointed out, her voice quiet.
She put a hand on his shoulder.
That's nothing to take lightly, given what you went through yesterday. You survived.
I get the feeling that when I get home, I'm going to wish I hadn't, Tavi said,
his voice choking, wry. He blinked away the tears and summoned up a smile for the young woman. She returned it.
Can I ask you something?
He shrugged.
Sure. Why endanger what you'd been working toward? Why did you agree to help this Beritta if you knew it could cause problems for you?
I didn't think it would, Tavi said, his voice plaintive. I mean, I thought I could have done it all. It wasn't until nearly the end of the day that I realized I was going to have to pick between getting all the sheep in and those holly bells. And I'd promised her.
Ah, said the slave, but her expression remained dubious.
Tavi felt his cheeks color again, and he looked down.
All right, he sighed. She kissed me, and my brains melted and dribbled out my ears.
Now that I can believe, Amara said.
She stretched her foot toward the water, flicking idly at its surface with her toes.
What about you? Tavi asked.
She tilted her head to one side.
What do you mean?
He shrugged and looked up at her again. Uncertain.
I've been doing all the talking.
You haven't said a thing about yourself.
Slaves don't usually wander around this far from the road, or a Steadholt, all alone. I figured that, you must have run away.
No, the young woman said firmly. But I did get lost in the storm. I was on my way to garrison to deliver a message for my master.
Tavi squinted up at her.
He just sent you out like that? A woman? Alone?
I don't question his orders, Tavi. I just obey them.
Tavi frowned, but nodded.
Well, okay, I guess. But do you think you could come along with me? Maybe talk to my uncle? He could make sure you got to garrison safely. Get you a hot meal, some warmer clothes?
The slave's eyes wrinkled at the corners.
That's a very polite way to take someone prisoner, Tavi.
He flushed.
I'm sorry, especially since you probably saved my life and all. But if you are a runaway and I don't do something about it, the law could come back to hurt my uncle.
He pushed his hair back from his eyes. And I've done enough to mess things up already.
I understand, she said. I'll come with you.
Thank you.
He glanced up at the doorway.
Sounds like the rain's stopped. Do you think it's safe to go?
The slave frowned and looked outside for a moment. I doubt it's going to get any safer if we wait.
We should get back to your steadholt before the storm gets bad again. You think it will?
Amara nodded, the motion confident.
It has that feel to it. All right. Are you going to be all right walking?
He glanced at her and down at her foot. Her ankle was swollen around a purpling bruise.
Amara grimaced. It's just my ankle, not the rest of the foot. It hurts, but if I'm careful I should be all right.
Tavi blew out a breath and pushed himself to his feet. All the cuts and injuries twinged and ached, muscle protesting. He had to brace his hand on the wall for a moment until he got his balance back.
Okay, then. I guess it isn't going to get any easier.
I guess not. Amara let out a small pained sound as she got to her feet as well.
Well, we make a fine pair of traveling companions. Lead the way.
Tavi headed out of the memoriam and into the chill of the northern wind blowing down from the mountains in the north and the sea of ice beyond. Though Tavi had kept the scarlet cloak from the memoriam, the wind was still almost enough to make him turn back inside and seek shelter. Frozen blades of grass crunched beneath his feet, and his breath came out in a steamy haze before his mouth, swiftly torn apart by the winds. There could be no more argument on the subject. Winter had arrived in full force upon the Calderon Valley, and the first snow could not be far behind. He glanced at the slave behind him. Amara's expression seemed remote, distracted, and she walked with a definite limp, bare feet pale against the icy grass. Tavi winced and said,
"We should stop before long to get your feet warmed up. We could strip one of the cloaks, at least try to wrap them."
"The wrappings would freeze," she said after a moment's silence. "The air will keep them warm better than cloth. Just keep going. Once we get to your steadholt, we can warm them up." Tavi frowned, more at the way her attention seemed fixed on things elsewhere than at what she had to say. He resolved to keep a close eye on her. Frozen feet were nothing to scoff at, and if she was used to life in the city, she might not realize how dangerous it could be on the frontier, or how quickly frostbite could claim her limbs or her life. He stepped up the pace a little, and Amara kept up with him. They reached the causeway and started down it, but had walked for no more than an hour when Tavi felt the ground begin to rumble, a tremor so faint that he had to stop and place his spread fingers against the flagstones in order to detect it.
"Hold on," he said. "I think someone's coming."
Amara's expression sharpened almost at once, and Tavi saw her draw the cloak a little more closely against her, her hands beneath it and out of sight. Her eyes flickered around them.
"Can you tell who?"
Tavi chewed on his lip.
"Feels kind of like Brutus. My uncle's fury. Maybe it's him."
The slave swallowed and said,
"I feel it now. Earth fury coming."
In only a moment more, Bernard appeared from around a curve in the road. The flagstones themselves rippled up into a wave beneath his feet, which he kept planted and still, his brow furrowed in concentration, so that the earth moved him forward in one slow undulation, like a leaf borne upon an ocean wave. He wore his winter hunting clothes, heavy and warm, his cloak one of Thanodont hide, layered with gleaming black feather fur, and proof against the coldest nights. He bore his heaviest bow in his hand, an arrow already strung to it, and his eyes, though sunken and surrounded by darker patches of skin, gleamed alertly. The steadholder came down the road as swiftly as a man could run, his pace only slowing as he neared the two travelers, the earth slowly subsiding beneath his feet until he stood upon the causeway, walking the final few paces to them.
"Uncle!" Tavi cried, and threw himself at the man, wrapping his arms as far around him as they could go. "Thank the furies! I was so afraid that you'd been hurt!"
Bernard laid a hand on Tavi's shoulder, and the young man thought he felt his uncle relax just a little. Then he gently, firmly pushed Tavi back and away from him. Tavi blinked up at him, his stomach twisting in sudden uncertainty.
Uncle, are you all right?
No, Bernard rumbled, his voice quiet.
He kept his eyes on Tavi steadily.
I was hurt. So were others because I was out chasing sheep with you.
But Uncle, Tavi began. Bernard waved a hand, his voice hard if not angry.
You didn't mean it, I know. But because of your mischief, some of my folk came to grief. Your aunt nearly died. We're going home.
Yes, sir, Tavi said quietly.
I'm sorry to do it, but you can forget about those sheep, Tavi. It appears that there are some things you aren't swift to learn after all.
But what about, Tavi began.
Peace,
the big man growled, a warning anger in the tone, and Tavi cringed, feeling the tears well in his eyes.
It's done.
Bernard lifted his glower from Tavi and asked,
Who the crows are you?
Tavi heard the rustle of cloth as the slave dipped into a curtsy.
My name is Amara, sir. I was carrying a message for my master from Reaver to Garrison. I became lost in the storm. The boy found me. He saved my life, sir.
Tavi felt a brief flash of gratitude toward the slave and looked up at his uncle hopefully.
You were out in that? Fortune favors fools and children, Bernard said.
He grunted and asked,
You're a runaway, are you?
No, sir.
We'll see, Bernard said. Come with me, lass. Don't run. If I have to track you down, I'll get irritable.
Yes, sir.
Bernard nodded and then frowned at Tavi again, his voice hardening.
When we get home, boy, you're to go to your room and stay there until I decide what to do with you. Understand?
Tavi blinked up at his uncle, shocked. He had never reacted like this before. Even when he'd given Tavi a whipping, there had never been the sense of raw, scantily controlled anger in his voice. Bernard was always in control of himself, always calm, always relaxed. Looking up at his uncle, Tavi felt acutely aware of the sheer size of the man, of the hard, angry glitter to his eyes, of the strength of his huge hands. He didn't dare speak, but he tried to plead with his uncle silently, letting his expression show how sorry he was, how much he wanted things to be right again. He knew dimly that he was crying, but he didn't care. Bernard's face remained hard as granite and as unforgiving.
Do you understand, boy?
Tavi's hopes crumbled before that gaze, wilted away before the heat of his uncle's anger.
I understand, sir, he whispered.
Bernard turned away and started walking down the causeway again back toward home.
Hurry up, he said without looking back. I've wasted enough time on this nonsense.
Tavi stared after him, shocked, numb. His uncle hadn't been this angry the day before when he'd caught Tavi leaving. What had made this happen? What could drive his uncle to that kind of fury? The answer came at once. Someone he cared about had been harmed. His sister Isana. Had she truly almost died? Oh, furies, how bad was it? He had lost something, Tavi knew. Something more than sheep or status as a skilled apprentice. He had lost his uncle's respect, something that he had only just begun to realize that he had possessed. Bernard had never treated him like the others, not really. Never shown him pity for his lack of fury craft, never assumed Tavi's incompetence. There had been, especially over the past few months, a kind of comradeship Tavi hadn't known with anyone else. A quiet and unobtrusive bond between near equals, rather than his uncle speaking down to a child. It was something that had been built slowly over the past several years, as he served as his uncle's apprentice. And it was gone. Tavi had never really realized it was there, and it was gone. So were the sheep. So was his chance at the future, of escaping this valley, escaping his own status as a furyless freak, an unwanted bastard child of the Legion camps. Tears blinded him, though he fought to keep them silent. He couldn't see his uncle, though Bernard's impatient snarl came to him clearly.
Tavi!
He didn't hear Amara start walking until he had stumbled forward after his uncle. He put one foot in front of the other blindly, the ache inside him as sharp and more painful than any of the wounds he had received the day before. Tavi walked without looking up. It didn't matter where his feet were taking him. He wasn't going anywhere. Chapter 15. For Amara, the walk back to Bernard Holt proved to be a long and arduous exercise in ignoring pain. Despite her words to Tavi earlier that morning, her ankle, injured during the wild landing beneath last night's storm, had stiffened and burned hideously, barely supporting her weight at all. Similarly, the cut Aldrich X. Gladius had dealt her back in the renegade camp throbbed and ached. She could barely ignore one injury without the other occupying her full attention, but even so she had enough presence of mind to feel pain on behalf of the boy trudging along in front of her. The reaction of his uncle had not been unkind, she thought at first. Many men would simply have commenced with beating the boy, and only after would they have had anything to say about why the beating had been delivered, if at all. But the longer she walked, the more clear it became just how deeply injured the boy had been by his uncle's words, or perhaps the lack of them. He was used to being treated kindly, and with some measure of respect. The quiet, cool distance that the steadholder had shown was new to Tavi, and it had hurt him badly, dashing his hopes for making a future for himself at the academy, and driving home the notion that without fury crafting of his own, he was nothing more than a helpless child, a danger to himself and others. And here, on the wild frontiers of the realm of humanity where life or death hinged on the daily struggle against hostile furies and beasts, perhaps it was true. Amara shook her head and focused on the stones of the causeway beneath her feet. Though she felt some empathy for the boy, she could not allow his plight to distract her from her task, namely to discover what was happening within the valley, and then to take whatever action she thought best to see to it that the realm was protected. She already had some facts to piece together, and her attention was best spent on them. The Marat had returned to the Calderon Valley, something that had not happened in nearly 17 years. The Marat warrior Tavi and his uncle had confronted could well have been an advance scout for an attacking horde. But the growing light of day made that possibility seem increasingly remote, bringing inconsistencies to light. If they had truly encountered a Marat, why had the boy's uncle showed virtually no relief upon finding his missing nephew? For that matter, how had the steadholder been on his feet again at all? If the wounds were as serious as the boy had described, it would have taken an extremely talented watercrafter to have had Bernard on his feet again, and Amara didn't think that anyone that skilled would live far from one of the major cities of the realm. Surely the injury must have been less than the boy described. And if that was true, then perhaps the incident with the Marat had been likewise exaggerated. Put into the context of fiction, Tavi's tale of his adventures the previous day made a great deal more sense. The boy, crushed with feelings of inadequacy, could have made up the tales in order to make himself feel more important. It was a far more plausible explanation of what he had told her. Amara frowned. It was a more plausible explanation, but the boy's courage and resourcefulness could not be denied. Not only had he survived the violent fury storm of the evening before, but he had also rescued her, at considerable danger to himself, when he could have taken himself to safety without risk. Such courage, conviction, and sacrifice rarely went hand in hand with falsehood. In the end, Amara decided that she had very little information to work with until she had spoken to the uncle as well, and he seemed to be in no mood for any kind of discussion. She would have to learn more. If the Marat were preparing to attack again, defending against them would require a major mobilization at the end of the year and at fantastic expense to both the High Lord of Riva and the Crown's treasury. There would be resistance to such news, and if she went to the local count with nothing more than the word of a shepherd boy to go on, she would doubtless hear endless repetitions of the tale of the boy who cried Thanodont. She would need the testimony of one of the count's trusted landowners, one of the steadholders, to get more than a token response. The best reaction she could hope for in such a case would be for the count to dispatch scouts of his own to find the enemy, and even if they managed to return from such a deadly encounter, it might be with a Marat horde on their heels. The Marat could swallow the valley in one assault and ravage the lands around Riva, while its High Lord, held captive by the onrush of winter, could do little but watch his lands be destroyed. Ideally, with Bernard's testimony, she might get the Count to mount a more active defence from garrison and to send to Riva for reinforcements. Perhaps even manage a preemptive strike, something that might disperse the wave of an oncoming horde before it broke upon the realm's shores. On the other hand, if there was no imminent invasion and the Crown's agent roused the local legions and incurred vast expenditure on Riva, it would be a major embarrassment before the other High Lords and the Senate. Gaius's reputation might not survive the subsequent attacks, further agitating the already restless High Lords with what could be tragic results. Amara swallowed. Gaius had assigned her to represent his interests in the valley. Her decisions would be his. And while he would bear the moral and ethical responsibility for her actions here, the High Lords might demand legal retribution against her for the misuse of Crown authority, and Gaius would be compelled to grant it. Imprisonment, blinding, and crucifixion were some of the gentler sentences she could expect from such a trial. The Crown's reputation, the possible security of the realm, and her own life rode upon her decisions. Best she make them carefully. She needed more information. They came to Bernard Holt sometime just after the sun reached its peak. Amara was struck at once by the solidity of the place. She had been born and raised in a steadholt, and she knew the signs of a strong holding, and one in a heightened state of alert. The steadholt's central buildings had walls higher than some military encampments, reaching nearly twice the height of a man, and made of seamless dark grey stone, laboriously raised from the ground by a powerful earthcrafter. The gates, heavy oak bound with steel, were half closed, and a grizzled holder wearing an old sword stood on the wall above them, squinting laconically out over the distance. Outbuildings stood not far from the walls, all of them one-story affairs, including what looked like a forge, a vast, gargant burrow, a combination barn and stables, and several animal pens. The granary she knew would be within the central enclosure, along with the kitchens, the living areas, and several smaller holding pens for animals, usually used only in emergencies. A pair of gargants, tended by a tall, handsome young man with wind-ruddy cheeks and black hair, stood in harness, waiting patiently while he threw several long, heavy ropes into a sack and secured it to one side of the harness.
"Frederick," Bernard called as they drew closer. "What are you doing with the team?"
The young man, already tall and strong for a boy not yet old enough to depart for the legions, tugged at a forelock with one hand and ducked his head to the steadholder.
"Taking them down to the south field to pull out that big stone, sir." "Can you handle the fury in that one?"
"Thumper and me can, yes, sir."
The boy started to turn away.
"Hello, Tarvey. Glad you're back in one piece."
Amara looked at the shepherd boy, but Tarvey barely lifted his gaze to the other young man. He waved a hand, the motion vague. Bernard grunted.
"There's another storm in the air. I want you back in 2 hours, Fred, whether the stone's moved or not. I have no intentions of more people getting hurt."
Frederick nodded and turned back to his work as Bernard strode on to the gates, nodded to the watchman over them, and slipped into the steadholt proper. Once inside, Bernard said,
"Tarvey."
The boy, without waiting to hear anything else, paced toward the side of the great hall and flung himself up the wooden staircase built along the outside of the building and into a door on the upper story, where Amara knew living quarters would commonly be situated. Bernard watched the young man vanish inside with a grimace on his face. Then he let out a heavy sigh and glanced back at her.
"You, come with me."
"Yes, sir," Amara said, and sketched a small curtsy. It was then that her ankle chose to give out on her altogether, and she wavered to one side with a little yelp. Bernard's hand shot out and gripped her shoulder through the scarlet cloak, steadying her, and closing tightly over the painful cut on her upper arm. She let out an involuntary gasp of pain, and her balance swam. The big steadholder stepped forward and simply picked her up as though she weighed no more than a child.
"Crow's girl," he muttered with a scowl. "If you were hurt, you should have said something."
Amara swallowed, as a pang of relief from her beleaguered body warred with a nervous anxiety at the steadholder's sudden proximity. Like Aldrich, he was an enormous man, but he exuded none of the sense of placid, patient danger that surrounded the swordsman. His strength was something different, warm and reassuring and alive, and he smelled of leather and hay. Amara struggled to say something, but wound up remaining awkwardly silent as the steadholder carried her into the great hall and then into the kitchens behind it, where warm air and the smells of baking bread wrapped around her like a blanket. He carried her over to a table near the fire and promptly sat her down upon it.
"Sir, really," she said, "I'm all right."
Bernard snorted.
"The crows you are, girl."
He turned and drew up a stool to the table and sat down on it, taking her foot quite gently between his hands. His touch was warm, confident, and again she felt soothed, as though some of that confidence had transferred into her by the touch.
"Cold," he said. "Not as bad as it could be. You used crafting to keep your feet warm?"
She blinked at him and nodded mutely.
"No substitute for a good pair of socks."
He frowned over her foot, fingers moving smoothly.
"Hurt there?"
She shook her head.
"There?"
Pain flashed through the whole of her leg, and she couldn't keep the grimace from her face. She nodded.
"Not broken. Sprain. We need to get your feet warmed up."
He rose and walked to a shelf, withdrawing a small copper tub. He touched a finger to the spigot above the washbasin and held his hand beneath it until the water streaming out steamed and turned his skin red with its heat. Then he started filling the tub. Amara cleared her throat and said,
"You are the steadholder, sir?"
Bernard nodded.
"Then you should not be doing this, sir. Washing my feet, I mean."
Bernard snorted.
"We don't hold much with that city nonsense out here, girl."
"I see, sir. As you wish, of course. But may I ask you another question?"
"If you like."
"The boy, Tavi. He told me that you were attacked by a Marat warrior and one of their warbirds. Is that true?"
Bernard grunted, his expression darkening. He tapped the spigot again rather sharply, and the water cut off with an apologetic little hiccup.
"Tavi likes to tell stories."
She tilted her head to one side.
"But did it happen?"
He placed the tub on the stool he'd sat upon a moment before and took her foot and part of her calf in hand. For a moment Amara was acutely conscious of the sensation of his skin upon hers, the way the cloak and her skirts had fallen to reveal her leg nearly to the knee. She felt her face heat, but if the steadholder took note of it, he gave no sign. He slipped her injured foot into the water, then motioned for her to put the other there as well. Her cold, numbed feet tingled unpleasantly, and steam curled up from the tub.
"How did you hurt your leg?"
he asked her.
"I slipped and fell," she replied.
She repeated to him her story about carrying a message to Garrison on behalf of her master, adding in a fall just before Tavi found her. The steadholder's expression darkened.
"We'll have to send him word. You're not in any shape to continue traveling for another day or two. Wait until your feet have warmed up. Then dry them off and have a seat."
He turned toward a larder, opened it, and withdrew a homespun sack full of tubers. He dropped that, a large bowl, and a small knife on the table.
"Everyone under my roof works, lass. Once you warm up, peel these. I'll be back directly to see about your arm."
She lifted a hand, resting it over the bandage on her opposite arm.
"You're just going to leave me here?"
"With that ankle, you won't be going far. And there's another storm rising. The closest shelter, other than this hall, is the Princeps Memoriam. And it looks like you've already cleaned that place out."
He nodded toward the scarlet cloak.
"I'd be thinking about what I was going to say to Count Graham about that if I were you.
Safeguarding the memoriam is his responsibility. I doubt he's going to be terribly happy with you, or your master, whoever he is.
Bernard turned and started to leave through the doors to the hall.
Sir, Amara blurted, you didn't tell me if it was true or not, what Tavi said about the Marat.
You're right, he said. I didn't.
Then he left.
Amara stared after the man for a moment in frustration. She looked from the doorway he'd vanished through, down to her feet in the steaming basin, and then back up again. Sensation was returning to her feet in an uncomfortable ripple of sharp pinpricks. She shook her head and waited for the feeling in her feet to return to something closer to normal. A maddening man, she thought. Confidence bordering upon arrogance. She would not be so poorly treated in any court in the realm. Which was the point, of course. This was not one of the cities. Here, on the Steadholt, his word was literal law on nearly any matter one could name, including the disposition and non-debilitating punishment of a runaway slave. Were she a slave in fact rather than in fiction, he could have done nearly anything to her, and as long as he returned her in one piece and capable of fulfilling her duties, the law would support him as though he were a citizen. Instead of caring for her and leaving her in a warm room with her feet in a hot bath, he could have as easily stabled her with the animals, or put her to any of a number of other uses. Her cheeks flushed again. The man had affected her, and he shouldn't have. She had seen him riding an earth wave. He was an earth crafter, after all. Some of them could affect the temperaments of animals and the base natures of human beings as well, draw out raw primal impulses that otherwise would never surface. That would explain it. But then, and more to the point, he had been very gentle with her when he held her. He needn't have done so much as let her onto his land, and he had all but forcibly pressed hospitality onto her. Despite his threats and words, he hadn't locked her in a cellar or shown anything but concern and kindness. Amara stirred her feet in the water, frowning. The Steadholder was clearly a man who commanded some measure of respect in his people. His Steadholt was solid and obviously prosperous. The hold folk she had seen had been clean and well-fed. His reaction to the boy had been severe in its own fashion, but restrained by the standards of most of the realm. Had the man wanted her, he could simply have taken her, and not bothered with crafting her into a frenzy. The contrast of his strength, physical and otherwise, against several demonstrations of gentleness was a surprising one. Though she had no doubts that he could be a hard man when called upon, she sensed a genuine kindness in his manner and an obvious love for the boy. Amara drew her feet from the tub and patted them dry with the towel, then lowered herself from the table and perched gingerly on another stool. She reached for the paring knife and one of the tubers, and started skinning the peel off of it, dropping the peel in a smooth spiral into the tub of water she'd just used, and depositing the flesh of the root into the bowl the Steadholder had left her. The task was soothing in its own way, repetitive, comforting. She had been through a lot in the past few hours. Her world had been shaken, and she'd faced death at close quarters more than once. That might explain the sudden vibrance of her emotions, of her pure physical reaction to the Steadholder. He was, after all, an imposing and not unattractive man, she supposed. She might have had the same reaction to anyone in such proximity to her. Soldiers reacted that way often when death was so near at hand, seizing at any opportunity to live life more richly, more fully. That must have been it, Amara decided. But that got her no closer to accomplishing her mission. She blew out a frustrated breath. Bernard had neither confirmed nor denied the encounter with the Marat. Any mention of it, in fact, seemed to have made him increasingly evasive. Much more so, she thought, than was reasonable for the situation. She frowned over that thought. The Steadholder was hiding something. What? Why? What she wouldn't have given at that moment to be a water crafter, to have been able to sense more about him, or to have had more experience in reading people's expressions and body language. She had to know more. She had to know if she had a credible witness to bring before the local count or not. She had to know if the First Lord's fears were viable.
Bernard came back a few moments later, carrying another bowl under one arm. The steadholder lifted his eyebrows, his expression surprised. Then he scowled at her, coming over to stand by the table.
"Sir?" she asked. "Did I do something wrong?"
"Crows, girl," Bernard said. "I thought you'd still be warming your feet up."
"You wanted me to peel these, sir?"
"Yes, but..."
He made an irritated noise.
"Never mind. Sit back, let me see your feet again. And your arm, while we're at it."
Amara settled back on her stool and the steadholder knelt down on the floor in front of her, setting the bowl to one side. He lifted her feet, grunted something, and then reached into the bowl, drawing out a small jar of some kind of pungent-smelling ointment.
"You've got some cuts from the hills," he said. "Doubt you even felt them, as cold as your feet were. This should help keep them clean and numb some of the pain when you start getting the feeling back."
He smoothed on the ointment with broad, gentle fingertips on both feet. Then he drew out a roll of white cloth and a pair of shears. He wrapped her feet carefully in the cloth and finally drew from the bowl a pair of slippers with flexible leather soles and a pair of grey woolen socks. She began to protest, but he shot her a glare and put both socks and slippers on her.
"Big feet for a woman," he commented. "Had some old slippers that should do for a while."
She studied him quietly during the process.
"Thank you. How badly off are they?"
He shrugged.
"They look like they'll be all right to me, but I'm no water crafter. I'll ask my sister to take a look at them when she's feeling better."
Amara tilted her head to one side.
"Is she ill?"
Bernard grunted and stood up.
"Move that cloak back and roll up your sleeve. Let me have a look at that arm."
Amara moved the cloak back from her shoulder. She tried to roll the sleeve of her blouse up, but the injury was high on her arm and the cloth bunched too much to allow it. She tried anyway, and the sleeve pinched in on the wound. Pain flashed through her arm again, and she sucked in a shaky breath.
Bernard said, "That's no good. We'll have to get you another shirt."
He lifted the shears and carefully started snipping the bloodied sleeve away, a little above the first cut in the fabric. He frowned at it and then at the scarlet cloth of the bandage. The frown only deepened when he unwound the bandage and found the cloth clotted to the wound. He shook his head, fetched fresh water and cloth, and began to soak the bandage and to pull gently at it.
"How did you hurt your arm?"
Amara used her other hand to brush at her hair, pulling it back from her face.
"I fell yesterday. I cut it."
Bernard made a quiet sound and said nothing more until he had soaked the cloth and teased it gently off of the cut without tearing it open. He frowned, and with the cloth and water and soap cleaned it gently. It burned, and Amara felt her eyes tear up again. She thought she would break down crying, simply from the exhaustion and the constant relentless pain. She closed her eyes tightly while he continued the slow, patient work. There was a rap at the kitchen door, and a nervous voice belonging to the boy he'd called Frederick said,
"Sir, they're asking for you outside." "I'll be there in a moment."
Frederick coughed.
"But, sir..."
The steadholder said, voice hardening slightly,
"Fred, in a moment."
"Yes, sir,"
the boy said. The door closed again. Bernard continued with the wound and murmured,
"This should have had stitches, or someone to craft it closed." "You fell?"
"I fell,"
Amara repeated.
"Apparently you fell along the blade of a sharp sword,"
the steadholder commented. He rinsed and dressed the wound once more, his hands gentle, but even so her arm throbbed and ached horribly. More than anything, Amara wanted to go somewhere dark and quiet and curl into a ball, but she shook her head and said,
"Sir, please, is the boy's story true? Were you really attacked by the Marat?"
Bernard took in a deep breath. He walked away and then came back to her and draped a soft, gentle weight over her shoulders, a blanket.
"You're asking a lot of questions, girl. Not sure I like that.
and I don't know if you're being honest with me.
I am, sir.
She looked up at him and tried to smile. His mouth crooked up at one corner. He glanced at her before turning away to pick up a towel, hanging